What did happen? Okay. See, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Diamonds. They were all dead. The others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episodes 1 and 2, LAX, Parts 1 and 2. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if Oceanic Airlines lost a piece of our luggage, what piece would that be? Mine is obviously the piece with all the pod in it, because that's just my luck.
Mine is the piece with all the podcasting equipment, because I'm always anxious to make sure I have my mic with me when I travel, because you never know when you're going to have to podcast.
And
I'm Joanna Robinson. Did you say I'm Dave Gonzalez?
I did, but before the question, so it might have been, you know.
Sorry.
Just like this week's episode, I came at it in parallel.
Oh, all right. We flippity-flopped. Anyway, hello, I'm Joanna Robinson. We've only been doing this for 5 seasons, plus many years.
And I'm Neil Miller, and the thing that the Oceanic Airlines would lose in my luggage would be a case of Vegemite, because after all the peanut butter talk, and then being told what Vegemite is in season 1 of our rewatch podcast, I would have to be bringing some back, for sure.
Excellent. I hope I pronounced Oceanic right the first time, but if not, you know.
You were close.
Perfect. I thought you were going to say the luggage with the pronunciation of Oceanic in it.
Lugage. Just lean right in. Well, you never know when it's somebody's first time, but that's an inside joke. If this is your first time, welcome. The podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island or LAX for the first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers of the final season. And then a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you will see time codes of when those sections start. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted to releasing the podcasts on Saturday evenings in the United States after our group live watches in our Storm Slack. How do you join those live watches, you ask? Why? You go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you will find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more bonus content. For instance, Joanna, this month we're entering the Matrix.
That's right. If you are just joining us, something that we do as bonus content in conjunction with the Buffering podcast is that Kristen Russo and I, once a month, roughly, try to pick 3 movies that Kristen hasn't seen, that I've seen, and we podcast about them and watch them together in our joint live watch Slack, because, you know, we just don't have enough to do. We want to create more work for ourselves, but actually it's a really good time. So we picked Keanu Reeves as the theme for the month of May. We're doing the Matrix, but really we're doing the Matrix, John Wick, Point Break are the 3 films we're watching. Kristen and I just recorded part 1, and I'm really pleased with the bonus game that I came up with, which is I played several Keanu Reeves woes for her, and I tried to get her to guess what the emotion behind the woes were and what movies they were from. So that and all that and more. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, that's where you can find that content. We've got bonus material for you every week. We do a lot. Let's just be real about it. Obviously that's, not the only way you can be in touch with us. You can always email us, host@stormpodcast.com. You can go to our website, stormpodcast.com, which has a calendar of all of our events. You can find us on Twitter @stormpodcast. We've got a new social media person, running that, and it's really exciting. So that's happening. And if you are in our Patreon Slack, we do a live watch every Saturday. This Saturday, as you're listening to this, we will have just watched LAX Parts 1 and 2. But the following Saturday, I, Joanna Robinson, will be hosting What Kate Does, which is episode 3 of season 6. And I can't believe we're in the final season already. It's wild. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot for us to talk about today. It's a 2-part great banger of an episode. So we're not going to hang out too long in this section. But I do have one email I absolutely have to read, and one very quick review. Very nice review from Beaker Northam, who suggested I do a Bristol accent, and I'm not going to do it, but thank you so much for the suggestion. 5 stars. And it's just really nice, so I'm just going to read it. It says, Joanna is my constant, and then there's like a little tornado emoji and some heart emojis, and it says, found the show through Joanna's always great work, but now I love all of you. Thank you. So thank you, Beaker Northam, for joining us in all of this. And that brings us to this email, which is just maybe, I don't think we're ever going to top this email.
Oh, wow.
I don't mean to like set expectations, but this email is the perfect email to go with this episode, because I think it had, like this episode or these two episodes, I think it has everything, which is like laughs, emotion, and a surprise cameo. So here we go. this email has been many years in the making, and in anticipation of the final season, I thought it would be now or never to write. My Lost origin story has been repeated on the pod many times, college roommates, Netflix DVDs, talking about it to anyone, everyone who would listen, so I have nothing original to add there. Now that the series is coming to a close, I thought it would be interesting to hear where people were both physically and in their lives as the show came to a close. As you've discussed, one of Lost's greatest strengths is the personal growth and journey of the characters. The survivors of Flight 815 are very different people going into season 6 than who they were when we first met them. I'm sure your listeners found themselves very different people as well when the show ended. Here's my Lost closure story in a non-spoiler way. I started Lost while attending college in Boston, but I didn't end up finishing it until 2 years after the finale aired. I was an avid weekly watcher for most of the show and was able to continue the habit via less than legal torrenting after I moved to Australia midway through season 4. After settling in Melbourne, I introduced my then partner to the show and we barreled through at a frantic pace to get caught up for season 6. Unfortunately, things took a turn for the worse and I found myself fleeing the relationship and the country before we could finish the season. Lost had always been such a positive memory, but due to how the show impacted my partner, and here the emailer puts like a little bit of a spoiler, so we're going to skip that part. Lost was now a very toxic and difficult piece of television to digest. I couldn't finish season 6. Fast forward 2 years later, I'm back in Boston and decide to finish the show. Watching the final season was like finally putting the past behind me and starting new. A reinvention like that is never easy, so I remember very little of how the show wrapped up. Almost a decade later, what is time? You announced the Lost Rewatch podcast. This is my opportunity to rewrite my association with the show from a place of fear, anger, confusion, and heartbreak to watching with humor, thoughtful analysis, and a wonderful community. I'll be watching season 6 for what feels like the first time, week by week with you all. My Lost closure story gets a happy ending in which I get to listen to my big brother and his two friends talk to me every week about a show that I have relearned to love. Keep up the great work, and I'm excited to experience this final season with you all. Stay upright, Kevin Gonzalez. So.
Aww.
I was like, by halfway through that email, I'm like, there's no way I know two people who have fled Australia because their partner suddenly turned toxic.
I was wondering, I was like, is it going to be the Boston clue? I was like, when is Dave going to know? And I was like, I was keeping one ear open for you to have like a reaction noise, but you didn't. Kept it
well,
cool.
I'm glad that he told that story because I can't tell that story to a podcast audience without clearing it by him first. But yeah, thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, so Dave's brother wrote us an email. I'm sorry. I'm just excited. Okay, that's all.
I'm excited for Kevin to do this with us. We are good people to watch Lost with, as it turns out.
Love this. So thanks to Kevin for the email. And I would love to, Kevin had a great idea. I would love to hear from other folks where they were in the final season of Lost, and how they remember processing it and all of that. I'm sure we will tell our own personal stories as we get a bit closer to the end. So that is it for my section. So I am very curious to know, Neil Miller, what in the blazes is happening on Lost?
A whole bunch of wild stuff happens in these two episodes of Lost, LAX parts 1 and 2. These episodes were written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. Both parts were directed by Jack Bender. And this two-part extravaganza aired on February 2nd, 2010, and it takes place on days 5 and 6 following the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. Remember that one? On the island, Kate, Jack, Sawyer, and the gang awaken back in 2007 at the Swan Hatch. As they intensely debate whether or not the plan worked, they also hear Juliet calling out from the bottom of the mining shaft and begin trying to dig her out. And while Sawyer does eventually get to her, Juliet is badly injured and eventually dies in his arms. It is extremely sad. Close by, Saeed bleeds out by the Dharma van as Hurley converses with the ghost of Jacob, who tells him to take Saeed to the temple. More on that in a moment. Back in the shadow of the statue, Richard and Ben deal with the aftermath of Jacob's murder. Flock, or Fake Lock, as we've been calling him, reveals himself to not just be the man in black, but old clickety-clack as well. In his smoky form, he makes quick work of Brahm and some of the other quote-unquote good guys. And after explaining to Ben that all he wants to do now is go home, the man in Locke's body beats up Richard and carries him into the jungle. It's very exciting. While Sawyer and Miles stay behind to bury Juliet, the rest of our Losties take Saeed to the Temple of Mystery, where they are promptly captured by a group of others. It's only after Hurley shows them a large wooden ankh in the guitar case that they agree to help Saeed. The others then dunk Saeed in a mysterious pool of dark water, and he dies. After Hurley tells the others about Jacob's passing, they freak out and begin preparing to defend the temple from him. Elsewhere, high above the Pacific Ocean, Jack Shepard is having a drink and surviving some minor turbulence on the way home to Los Angeles. Rose and Bernard are there. Kate and the U.S. Marshal are there. Leslie Arst is there talking to a very chipper Hugo Reyes. Sun and Jin are there together. Even John Locke and Boone and Frogert are there sharing a row. In the end, Flight 815 lands safely in Los Angeles. In this Twilight Zone-esque alternate reality, we may notice several new developments aboard Flight 815. First, Desmond is on the plane. Hurley claims to be the luckiest guy in the world. A very much alive Boone explains that he couldn't convince Shannon to come home. Fair enough. John Locke has completed his walkabout in Australia. Charlie, who's still there, chokes on a bag of heroin in the bathroom, only to be saved by a pair of strangers named Saeed and Jack. And right before landing, we hear the comforting voice of Greg Grunberg as pilot Seth Norris, who has finally successfully landed Flight 815.
Snap after Wexley, all these Seth years. Norris! Most important character in Star Wars.
After disembarking Flight 815, Kate makes her escape as we knew she probably would, while the airline informs Jack that they lost his father's casket. Later, at the lost luggage office, he meets a wheelchair-bound John Locke and offers to give him a free medical consultation. To be continued on that front. This massive two-part episode ends back on the island, at the temple, where Jack's stubborn nature is getting him in trouble with the others. Their scuffle, of course, is short-lived, however, because a few feet away, the previously dead Saeed sits up and begins talking. Fun fact about this episode, according to Damon Lindelof, Carlton Cuse, on the commentary track, the DVD commentary track for this episode, the scene where Sawyer and Juliet are under the wreckage of the Swan had to be filmed twice. The original film they had a problem with and it was ruined, so they had to get Elizabeth Mitchell to come back from Vancouver, where she was filming ABC's hit show V. And they had to film the scene a second time, which I imagine was emotionally tough.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the first one take wasn't as good, possibly. That's a possibility.
Sure. I think we have to assume at this point.
They're laying, forget everything on the table in the version that we get. I can't imagine doing that.
And it's like, hey, can you just come back and do that again?
Can you go
just
to that place again, Josh Holloway?
All right. In honor of that emotionally devastating scene with Sawyer and Juliet, this week's calm question: have you ever been on a date that in which you have gone Dutch? Which, as folks who watched this the first time and didn't know that concept, Googled and found out, is when you just split things equally between the people on the date. I will start. Pretty sure I remember the first time I went Dutch with someone. It's a good thing to do every once in a while. But I think I also was doing that cool thing where I was like, hey, do you want to come see a movie? We'll go to a free movie screening. And then, so that allowed me to have also some feeling cool points in addition to being like, yeah, I'll go Dutch. I'm cool. But I'm curious if you guys have ever gone Dutch on a date. Joanna?
Most of them, because I think as like a
big fan of the Dutch lifestyle.
Yeah, I like the wooden shoes and the tulips and women paying as well as men. Yeah.
All right.
I mean, my answer is also most of my dates, but just because I lived in New York and was poor. So it was like, yeah, you want to go eat at a restaurant? We will have that. I will be having the maximum amount of my money for food. And you know, hopefully they wanted to meet in the middle. It sounds gross, but that's the reality.
All right.
Yeah, it makes it also sounds different when you're like both, you know, like 22 than it does like now. If I was like, well, you know, we should really split this.
I mean, I think there are like sometimes when like, I mean, I think eventually you get to a point, or I don't know, I've eventually gotten to the point where it's like you trade off who's paying. Like, I got this one, you know, and then you stop keeping track. And it's just sort of like, so I guess like going Dutch on a date is like a very early, feels like a very early conversation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Because like after it becomes like in a swing of things.
Yeah.
It's like, can I pay for this because I get points on my Amazon card, please?
Right, exactly. Or like, you covered the PG&E, so I'll buy dinner or something. I don't know. That's definitely an equal trade. Anyway.
Well, you make the car payment, so I've got the fries.
Don't worry, I'll get the fries. I got this.
All right. Where do we want to start this episode? Elsewhere or back on the island? Neil?
I would like to start on the island.
Excellent choice.
Because
I have a question about time traveling and displacement through time, which is, it seems like, you know, Hurley and Jin and Saeed, they basically blink through a bright light, as Jin describes it, and they just travel through time. They even brought the van with them, I guess, through the, if you're touching it, you get to travel through time with it.
Yeah, it's
just
the
like
compass
Jin
rules.
And his driftwood.
Exactly. But then we have the people in the Swan station area, and we know Juliet goes from being down the hole in the past to being down the Swan hole in the 2007 present. And then it seems like, you know, Jack and Miles and everybody else is sort of placed around the island near where they'd be. Kate is in a tree.
Yeah.
So, like, my question is, does Kate have the capability to, like, move through time and space? Or was there actually, like, a nuclear explosion that just, like, started to blow Kate back and then she blipped into time, time period?
I mean, I think this feels similar to when Desmond was there during the implosion of the Swan. Kate lucked out, got to keep her clothes. Good for her. But definitely ended up in a different spot. But I love the way this opens. First of all, I love, you know, if we're going to do an eye opening, why not have it be Kate? That's great. And then I love the way they designed the sound in this sequence, sort of the muffled. And a fun fact for those folks who have been listening since our Game of Thrones days, but if you ever went to Con of Thrones and you saw a great panel by Paula Fairfield, who was a sound designer on Game of Thrones, she also worked on Lost during season 6. So I don't know if this is one of hers. Oh my God. Like a big sound team.
I forgot about that. I'm adding Paula to my guest wish list.
Yeah. She did, I think, 4 seasons and definitely in season 6.
I remembered that. I forgot to remember it when we got to the seasons that she worked on.
Right? Because, yeah, she did. I don't think she started until, like, season 3.
She's like, I think I remember, you know, Paula's a pal, right? And, like, when we started this, she's like, oh, boy, you're doing Lost? Okay. Bye, adios. So we'll see if she'll talk to us about that.
Yeah. But I love the way they designed that scene. I like opening on Kate and sort of her sort of stumbling back into the confusion of what happened.
Well, there's so many season one, like season one mirrors and season one episode one mirrors, right? In this episode, a gajillion of them, too many to count. But that just puts Kate in the Jack position, right? Like. Mm-hmm. Everyone, like, why did Jack land in the jungle?
Right,
exactly. And everyone else landed on the beach. Like, why is Kate up a tree and everyone else is, like, where they were? So,
yeah, I mean, I guess the easiest explanation is that there was some sort of explosion, like, that the force, because Kate was, like, right, because Jack and Sawyer were already dragging Sawyer, like, off.
Yeah, I think they both ended up point. About where they... would
and
be.
Kate was sort of like right on top of the mining shaft. So she may have actually been just thrown.
Literally straight up in the air.
Yeah.
Landed
in her favorite place, the tree.
I know. I was going to say, or maybe Kate was just sleep climbing again. can't stop Kate from climbing.
Gotta get high. What? Oh, literally.
Literally high. Up in the tree.
Yep.
Yeah. So we could sort of intuit along with Kate and a very angry Sawyer. Before they decide to go looking for Juliet under the wreckage, that whatever we thought was going to happen via Jack unwriting time has not there. Back at the hatch, and the hatch existing means that the hatch existing and being blown up means that Desmond blew it up, means that Desmond was down there, means that we're back seemingly in the reality that we left when they blipped back into 1977.
Yeah. And I think what's great about that is that it is a very sort of simplified and very quick to pick up on, oh, exactly what happened was they just shot right back through time. So they're in the same physical place. They're just back on their regular main timeline, which I think the simplicity of that balances well with the just
the
massive
fuckery?
Question marks about everything else that's happening. when we get that slightly different flash noise, you'll notice it is not the same as the flashback noise from previous seasons. It's a little bit different.
It is. We gotta stay on the island. Mm-hmm. I wanna flash all on its own. So we get everybody gets together and manages to lift a bar off of the Swan to get down to Juliet, who has been transported from precarious hold position to precarious hold position. And then finally, Sawyer gets down there. Don't worry, we'll get back to the ghost Jacob. But in the very powerful scene we've already referenced once, Sawyer and Juliet do get more of a final moment than her just falling down the swan hole. Too many holes in this show.
Please don't say swan hole.
But yeah, it's a moment that gives it a resolution that makes me feel slightly better about Juliet being now apparently really dead. But having assumed that she was probably dead at this point, it was nice to have that moment where they actually got to say goodbye to each other, even though it's heartbreaking that it didn't work. Joanna, was this distant enough both in our rewatch and real time from Juliet sort of trying to get Sawyer to unright their whole relationship. Does this right all wrongs, all messy plot wrongs?
I don't know if the time or distance. I don't know if I have a great answer for you about unwriting all messy plot wrongs. What I will say is that sometimes I just watch this scene on YouTube if I want to feel something. This is one of the just most emotional things I've ever seen on television. It's like the flip side of Desmond and Penny at the end of the constant, like, I love you, I love you, I love you, I'll find you no matter what. Like, you know, that's that like big joyous sort of thing. And this is just like the fucking saddest goodbye. Mm-hmm. Josh Holloway they're both extraordinary, but you know, Liz Mitchell just has to have some raspberry jam on her face and she's dying. And like, but Josh Holloway, Jesus Christ, this whole two episodes. But like, he comes in so hot and he doesn't like turn it down for a very long time this season. And like so hot that Hurley hears him 2 minutes away in the jungle, like screaming at Jack and stuff like that.
Well, also, so, like, the only way they could get him into the temple is he gets attacked off screen and he takes five people down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the position Sawyer's in right now. And I think that's, you know, like when we talk about, it's complicated to talk about fridging Juliet because I don't really feel that way because Elizabeth Mitchell had decided to do this other show, right? And they could have not killed her, but they decided to kill her and her. So in doing so, her death really matters. It means something. And this is, you know, if we strip the fridging out of it, this is what we would want as a reaction to a character death, which is the extreme performance we get from Josh Holloway here, which is not, I think, over the top. I think it's right where it needs to be, given, you know, what we felt like we learned about James and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact it has on Jack as well. Because, you know, of all the things that Jack has fucked up, to me, this is the one he feels the worst about. And for Jack detractors, you can be like, okay, well, what is that worth? He feels bad about fucking up again. But to me, this is a pivot point for Jack. A huge pivot point is Juliet's death.
Remember, right at the end of the last season, this was the moment where Jack was like super sure.
Yeah,
like he went full man of faith. I know what I'm supposed to do.
I could fix everything.
And then it just straight up didn't work.
And Juliet died in the process, and he has to. It's not just, oh, he feels bad. It's that what we see immediately from Jack is this deference to other people and this acceptance of responsibility. I know I'm like zooming off topic.
Jack. So, you know, in Die Hard, which you guys recently watched for feels like the first time, how it's like you gotta to get rid of the jet lag, you gotta make the fist with your toes immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
Jack immediately after time traveling is just too submissive to have any ideas of his own. Like, it happened when he went back to 1977 for a brief period of time, and then Faraday showed up and was like, you could fix it. And Jack's like, oh. But it's like right after Jack time travels, he's just like, I don't know. I don't know anything.
Maybe, or maybe that he's actually learned this time. We'll see. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, he's taking
He did learn at the time travel, but he also then gives up some control at the temple and drowns Saeed in front of him. So I feel like there's a lot of good Fox face acting where it's like he looks troubled and he could be troubled for a bunch of reasons I could read into, which must be like a great gift to know you could give an actor like a line and then be like, and then you'll make something of it with his face.
Well, he's seen in control to Hurley, you know, he's like, Hurley's like, are you ready? You know, like he says, ready when you are, Hurley, like, you know, I'm following your lead. We're going to do what you say we should do. And when, you know, the people at the temple want to talk to someone, it's Hurley. And when they ask what happened to Saeed, Jack's like, it's my fault. I didn't shoot him, but it's my fault. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to give Jack too much credit, but I'm really in a position where I'm interested in where Jack goes from here. But anyway, yeah. we can zoom back to Sawyer and Juliet.
He just got so close to being this, you know, smart and humble back in 1977.
I don't know. He lost control of that pretty quickly.
He took a pretty quick left turn there at the end and was like, let's blow up the whole thing.
As soon as they were like workmen, he's like, I don't know, man. I don't know about that. So, yeah.
But
he needed a speech from Sawyer to like settle down, and then he settled down. And then anyway, I guess we remember season 5 differently.
That's the sort of the thing about Jack and Sawyer, right? They have this emotional push-pull throughout the entire series. And I think what's really interesting is the way that those performances sort of bounce off of each other. Like the just pure white hot rage that comes from Sawyer, from what Josh Holloway is doing in that scene where he's like screaming at him. Mm-hmm. You can see that really reflecting back as something that is affecting Jack very deeply in the moment. Like Jack knew that he screwed up, but then when he sees sort of the pain and the rage that he's caused in Sawyer, sort of takes it to another level. And I think that's where Jack is like, all right, well, this one really is on me. My bad, extreme bad. I'm going to maybe hang back for a minute, you know? And that's a good decision for Jack.
Luckily, we have someone telling Hurley what to do, which is Jacob, who reveals his ghost self to Hurley, tells him to take Saeed to the temple, make sure he still has the guitar case, really, really setting up those dominoes for a whole bunch of coincidences that get our losties into the temple. But he is the island god, so here he is being, I think, pretty active in island happenings compared to the previous 5 seasons, or at least letting his presence be known. But rather than showing up to his followers at the temple, he sort of allows Hurley to be the messenger of his death. It could all connect to the fact that there's this mystery Ankh, and inside that there's a list of the people who were going to show up at the temple that day.
That's so stupid.
Do you feel?
I hate everything about it. Can I just say really quickly? I'm just going to get this out of the way. I love Ghost Jacob. I think all that stuff is really great, and I think it's great how Hurley reacts like to him being dead. Like, I'm sorry, dude. Like, that sucks. Great, great stuff. Everything about the temple. I'm just going to say it for the commies. I hate. And I'm just going to say it, and just so you know it, I hate the temple. The end. And the Ankh is connected to that. The Ankh is so stupid. Like, why wouldn't Jacob just give... I mean, the point is that Hurley could have something that looks like it was Charlie's guitar case, mm-hmm. I guess. But why wouldn't he just give him a rolled up piece of paper in like a, I don't know, a small vial, something much easier to transport than a giant guitar case and a wooden Ankh.
Couldn't they just stick a post-it note to a guitar and put it in the guitar case?
There's so much stupid shit that happens at the temple. Like Dojin, like turning the giant, like every time you see a giant artifact, just know that I'm rolling my eyes and it's the giant hourglass timer on the temple pool. It's their like bamboo trebuchet firework launcher thing. It's like everything about the temple. It's
wear. I'd like to make a comment about the trebuchet firework rocket thingy. Okay. How is it possible that they light that thing with a torch and not set the entire thing on fire?
Great question.
Is it that they lit it with a big ass torch and only the wick of the rocket lights? This is ridiculous technological things, and these are the questions that Lost never answers that I'm mad about.
And I mean, it starts promising because I love the whole like tell Jin to take you to the hole where the French people were, and like that's all of that is like really fun. It's so fun to have Hurley as like the interpreter of Jacob here. Like that's great stuff. But as soon as they get into those like catacombs and the camera's doing that dumb weird jerky thing and you're supposed to be like, whoa, where's everyone going? I mean, that's, you can mark it. That from there afterwards, bad, in my view. So
I like the design of the temple. The production design is great.
I think the temple
looks cool.
Yeah, like they also live in 2007 though. So like say you're Cindy
and the kids.
Sure. And the kids.
Cindy with her new hairdo and a little bit of flair.
Uh-huh. And it's like, we have this town, this Otherton, and that's, you know, cool. We're going to live there, and we're only going to go, like, barefoot through the jungle so we don't make a whole bunch of sound and to, you know, like, scare the normies with our whispering. And then it's like, well, there's going to be an assault on the island. You gotta move out of your house and into this temple. And they're like, we'll just adapt as if we're medieval people. We'll let our hair grow out long and we'll live dirty once again. And like maybe in tents, I don't know where people are sleeping, but there isn't any modern stuff put on this temple. The temple just like exists. And like there's a table that Dojin has that apparently they moved in.
Do the kids have like vaccines or like penicillin? Like that's my question. Is I'm like, if I'm Cindy and I'm in charge of Zach and Emmer, like, am I like, yes, this is the life these two children who crash in an airplane with me should be living? I mean, maybe. I mean, it kind of feels culty, right? And like, mm-hmm. I think we're supposed to think of these others because they're acolytes of Jacob. We're supposed to think of them as positive. But like, I have to wonder, and I did zero research on this, but like the fact that this red color seems to be their, you know, color of choice. Most of them are wearing this red color. It reminds me of the Rajneeshian like compound in Oregon from Wild Wild Country, if you guys watched that, or mm-hmm. from Real History, but also from that docuseries. Like, I would not go live in the temple. Even if John Hawks were there, I would not go live in the temple.
Do you almost read this as like, these are the even more serious people? Like, this is who Richard was hanging out with the whole time.
That's what it seemed like. They were like, there's like,
while Ben was playing house in New Otherton.
There's like the running water others, and then there's the like, no, we're so hardcore. Also, follow up question, in the scramble, when it's like, you know, pour the ash, man the wall, all that sort of stuff. I don't know if you guys caught this shot of this one woman whose job appeared to be gathering flowers. She's just gathering flowers and then she runs inside the temple. And I'm like, is that your job at the temple, to go around and pick flowers? I mean, nice work, I guess, if you can get it. But I don't understand the workflow.
Very culty.
Workflow this whole at this temple is very dicey. So.
Well, and I will say, you mentioned John Hawks, great actor. We also get Hiroyuki Sanada, who folks will recognize as being in the most recent Mortal Kombat movie, among many other credits. So you have like these two really great actors that show up as our new sort of others. But most of what they're doing is very dumb. Except I will say, I would love to have the, like, whatever Dojin's like office is. This, like, where he's got all the plants and stuff,
his
like that.
Herb garden office.
Yeah, his like inside garden. That's kind of a cool room. I could see working in that space.
I think it's also extremely, extremely cool to speak English but decide you don't want to speak English and just make John Hawks hang out with you all day. Yeah.
The explanation of why he only speaks Japanese is pretty great.
Oh, it's great. It's great stuff. Yeah. Everything else is bad. Dave, where do you stand on the temple stuff?
Well, the everything else, just to remind people, is they're like, oh man, let's bring, if Saeed dies, it's bad, apparently, because his name's on a piece of paper, so we're going to bring him to this water, but oh no, the water is like not clear, which apparently it usually is. Why would I know? I've never seen it before. So the one character slices his hand and puts it in, and it just like washes off the blood like normal water, but doesn't seem too fazed by that. Says there might be consequences, flips a timer, they drown Saeed, and it's all very confusing because apparently they're like, well, it didn't work, he's dead, and then leave, and then yada yada yada, Saeed is not dead after a lengthy period of time.
I actually think this is the moment in the show that my mom started disliking Lost. Because as I've mentioned before on this podcast, she was a big Saeed person. She did not enjoy watching Saeed die, even though he wakes up at the end of part two.
Guess what? He's very good.
He's very good.
He's like, death, what's that?
Earlier on in the episode, he's like, wherever I go, it won't be good. And yep, he's in the temple.
In this, like, in this pool that looks like it's got Lipton iced tea in it. And if I'm Dojin, I'm not putting my cut hand in that water. And I'm certainly not putting my Saeed in that water. Yeah, and we don't know, you know, here in the calm, we don't know why the water looks like that necessarily, but it doesn't seem great.
They don't seem too happy about it, for sure.
And I do like, you know, just before, a little bit before Saeed comes back, there's that moment when Hurley's like, you know, if you need to talk, like, I'm here. And Miles has that weird look. And my interpretation of that is that Miles is like, I don't think this dude's dead, because I'm not getting that usual dead vibe.
I'm not getting his final thoughts.
Yeah.
It's like Miles' powers work much better with, like, a freshly dead body, it seems. Like, right? So he can sort of, the way he explained it previously is that he can sort of just, like, see what's going on in their brain as the brain is falling apart or stop from working. Whereas, like, Hurley, it seems like ghosts show up to him a little bit later, you know, and they show up in, like, full ghost form. So, yeah, I love that look, that just that little look that Miles gives, where it's like, something's not right here.
Also, while we're talking about allusions to previous seasons, is it possible that we're seeing a version of things that saved Baby Ben back in the 70s?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's the assumption, is that this is the same pool that they...
It's the spring.
They just spared us the scene of them forced drowning a child, which, you know, thank you, Loss.
But this is what healed Ben, but the water looks Liptonier now, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Well, but there was also, you know, apparently things about healing Ben, which is that made him, like, permanently another or changed him in some way, according to Richard Alpert. So Saeed comes back, but he's in... Everybody is amazed by this. The people who know about the resurrection pool are amazed by this. Jack is amazed by this. Obviously, Miles, as you guys covered, is amazed by this. So we're in a mystery Saeed period in the temple for our cliffhanger. But I want to loop back while we're still with Miles, because at the grave of Juliet, Sawyer makes him use his ghost powers to... Two separate uses of ghost powers for both of our ghost brothers this pair of episodes. To hear what Juliet was trying to tell him. She was going to say something very important. And the answer is, it worked.
What does that mean?
No one's happy with that answer, though. I think that's
the
important thing. Like, Miles, clearly, he probably hoped for a better answer to be able to give the just emotionally wrecked Sawyer, and Sawyer seems genuinely very confused, because Juliet did also was like, it didn't work while they were down in the hole, right? She was very upset about the fact that she was not able to, you know, reset things and save him, and so for that last thought to be it worked is quite the mystery going forward, I would say.
The other Miles thing I want to say that I didn't mention earlier, when you were talking about the sound design is so good at the beginning, but then you also get the benefit of, like, the Miles comedy. Like,
what something's happened with my hair.
Everything with Miles is great in this episode, as it always is, and I think that line reading he has when he's like, that's why you wanted me to stay behind, you know, like, and he's still calling Sawyer boss and, like, all that sort of stuff like that, like, it, you know, just, he's like, I thought you wanted to be bro friends together, you wanted me here for emotional support, you wanted me for my ghost tricks. Oh yeah. So,
and I love it as a move for Sawyer as part of his processing, is like, he's not giving up on getting that last answer. And you know what, if you had a friend who could listen in on the thoughts of people who had recently died, I think you'd do it too. Like, who wouldn't, right?
Yeah.
Indeed. All right, we're still on the island, but I think we're going to leave our temple buddies over in the temple and zoom over to the foot of the statue. What statue? Who knows? What's foot? It doesn't matter. But what we do know is that that was the place that Jacob once lived before he was stabbed by Ben, kicked into the fire, and instantly burns up into nothing.
Burns all the way. Not even teeth left on that guy.
And Ben apparently watches all of it, just like slowly watching somebody burn away over.
Speaking of needing some time to process,
yeah.
Yes,
Ben has quite the ride in this episode.
Good old Flock says that he now wants to talk to Richard and sends Ben outside, and Ben then gets super confused because Richard is like, "Here's John Locke's body." And there's a big kerfuffle about who's going to go in there until finally Alana sends in her crew. Or does Brom just decide to go in on his own?
I think he bullies his way in. He's like, "We're going in there. I'm going in with you, blah, blah."
I'm the biggest guy and I got the gun.
I like to hope that Alana was like, "Oh yeah, sure. You go ahead. I'm going to hang back here."
Because nothing a suspicious smarter than you. About this situation.
I don't like just that guy ahead. At all, and I'm happy he's dead. But one of my favorite interactions before he dies is him like rah, 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 at Richard, and Richard like kind of in the background, because you get like the dry Lapidus sort of son commentary in the background. Richard's like, "Okay, just back up there," you know, like Richard's just like, "Back the take two steps back, my friend." I think Son on Island only has like two lines, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Lapidus gets to do his whole like routine, but
I'm not buying it either.
Anyway, yeah, okay, so Brom goes in the temple.
Brom goes in the temple. There he decides to be Flock is like, "Hey, there's no Jacob, he's dead, you guys are free, you could leave, because if your whole job was to be his bodyguards, his body is literally turned into ashes and here anymore, you're done, be free." And they're like, "No, attack." Then Flock turns into the smoke monster and kills them all.
This is so exciting. We can finally say this.
Yeah, we can call him Smokey. We're going to have to bleep that out when that accidentally happens.
Yeah, so the man in black, which, I mean, a lot of people guess this, but we didn't want to confirm it until this cool moment. The man in black is also the smoke monster.
Mm-hmm. Which means he cannot be killed by conventional weapons.
Yeah, it's true. Don't shoot at him. And then also, I think it's also safe to say, I mean, what's the episode? What's the Ben episode that's really fun to rewatch in last season? Anyway, if you rewatch that episode.
Oh, the episode where they go from the Hydra Island really quick over to Frank and her son and Lapidus end up in Dharmaville.
Yeah. And no. The one where like Alex is there.
Yeah.
So if you watch that, knowing that he's the smoke monster and he can like turn into various people if he wants to, that's like John is a smoke monster going like, "Okay, Ben, you go down that hole." And then smoke monster is Alex showing up down the hole and fucking with Ben. And then Ben coming out of the hole and John back, smoke monster back and John being like, "What happened down there, buddy?" And then also Ben calling the smoke with his, you know, his drain phone,
his mystery toilet,
and the bushes rattling, and Ben's like, "The thing that's coming out of there is the scariest thing, you can't control it." And then it's John, and you're like, "Oh, haha, it's just John." But no, it's also the smoke monster.
The flushing worked.
Boom, 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 boom,
boom.
It
was the smoke monster all along.
Oh my God, it's so fun.
So we can intuit some rules from this, yes, from what we've seen, which is person needs to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've seen him take over a live person that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And it could seemingly shapeshift at will between smoke and human form.
But needs to leave quickly. The room in order to do so.
I think I'm
he leaves guessing, the room every time.
I'm guessing that's a production budget question and not necessarily a rule, but yeah, let's say
it's like when Clark Kent steps into the phone booth, he comes exactly. out, he's a totally different guy.
John needs to take off his tie glasses. No, but it is a great entrance for that smoke monster in that moment coming mm-hmm. around yes. the corner
and just expanding and being huge.
So good.
And Ash, apparently, if you make a unbroken ash circle, that will protect you from the smoke monster.
Unless he throws a giant rock at you.
Oh man!
Yes, like he's so unless you step smart. Out of the, unless you step out of the circle, but which gives a little bit of an answer to why they were so concerned when they figured out the ash circle around the cabin had been broken,
mm-hmm. and why they were dumping ash around the temple.
Yes,
but so ash of what?
That's a good question. It seems like everybody has like a bag of ash, right?
Yeah, but I feel like it has to be. I feel like you can't just like
it's just it comes in a bag frond. And it just says Dharma ash.
I feel like it has to be consecrated ash of some kind. I don't know.
I mean, it seems like from the evidence that we've gathered on screen in this episode, it's flower ash, right?
Oh yeah, that lady had mm-hmm. a special job, which is gather
the
special
flowers, burn the flowers, put the ash in the
fill
bag.
The ash bags.
I want to go back to the cabin for a second.
Yeah.
Because they made a point of showing us, oh, the ash is broken. Do you feel like it's safe to assume that it was John Locke finding the cabin that ultimately trampled over the ash? And because my interpretation is that ash was there to keep the Man in Black inside, which is weird because we also saw the smoke monster all over the island. So I don't understand that one. But like, is it John Locke finding the cabin in previous seasons that broke the ash line?
I mean, what's frustrating about that, if that's the case, is that we never saw him break the ash line.
Mm-hmm.
We only saw Alana reacting. Yeah, we only saw Alana reacting to the ash line being broken. And if I were John Locke and I were a man of faith and I saw an ash line, I would step over it. I sure. wouldn't mm-hmm. shuffle on through it.
Well, and he sees Ben step over it, so that's how we knew it was there in the first place. So we assume at least that time he did. But here's the thing. It moves throughout the island, so having like a circular
does the ash,
you know,
go with
ash,
it?
Or? Yeah, it's some wiggly sci-fi. I don't even know if that counts as sci-fi ash. It's wiggly ash logic, but it definitely wants to reinforce here, season 6, episode 1. Apparently, the only hope you have against Black Smoke Man is an ash circle. Or maybe being inside the temple, but even that seems to require some ash barrier. Anyway, we learned that Black Smoke kills some people, impales Brahm on some wood spike in a pretty gnarly effect for Lost, and then walks outside and just pummels Ricardus after saying, it's good to see you out of those chains.
Man.
Okay, first of all, hello, Richard. It's good to see you out of this out of those chains. Incredible line. We're like, what chains? I'm so excited to find out. Secondly, great stuff from Nestor Carbonell in this episode. He doesn't have like a ton to do, but the point when he has to like drag Michael Emerson, Ben, over to see like John's dead body, mm-hmm. it's so good. He's just got this like physical, like, I'm in charge. But am I in charge? Because, like, I love that part when Alana's like, who is in charge? And I'm like, yes, Alana. What is the org chart of this goddamn island? Jacob's dead. Who's in charge? Who was in charge when Jacob was alive, et cetera? But I don't know. There's just something. Do you know what I mean? Something mm-hmm. about
And there's also
Richard's.
The delivery of when he's like, you. Like, when he figures out mm-hmm. who he's talking to. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, man, imagine being Richard, right? and all this time, you know, oh, man, it's great. It's great. he just realizes that he's in a lot of trouble.
I have a question. If you see a dead body of John Locke, but you also saw a John Locke walk into the base of the statue, oh, like, how many shape-shifting things does Richard know about on this island to not immediately be like, I know what's in there? Like, this island a mystery, man. Richard's probably seen some shit.
Sure.
Yeah, what does Richard know and when did he know it is a good question, I think, to ask. Should we talk about the conversation that Ben and Smokey have, though?
About
the death of John Locke?
Go for it.
I don't know. It's really upsetting.
I mean, this would seem like a good place for flock antagonist check-in. because this man is still twisting the knife in poor old Ben, even seemingly after he did the thing that Ben was like around for. We got devious plans, but the new plan is not to kill God, but he wants to go home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then Terry O'Quinn decides to give like the most menacing face anyone has ever given to camera.
Just so you know who the bad guy is now.
Well, and I also think that the way he describes John Locke's final thoughts is something that might firmly take John Locke out of the antagonist category.
Yes.
Because John Locke genuinely confused as to why like Ben was doing this. I think John was still acting with such earnest faith about wanting to do what was best for the island that, I don't know, it almost seems like it annoys the man in black. You know, he's kind of like, you know, John was a goody two shoes kind of thing. And he's using it obviously to make Ben feel bad. But I agree with you that fake Locke is definitely the antagonist. He is just a hurricane of dick moves, especially in this episode. even not liking Brahm as I did and wanting to see him get impaled on Jacob's loom, still some pretty over the top stuff from old Smokey.
What a way to go! Yeah, so I get so mad. Like of all the things that the man in black, Smokey, has done. Him talking shit about John Locke is what makes me hate him the most. Mm-hmm. He calls him pathetic and irreparably broken. And I'm like, stop talking about John Locke that way. And like what works so well, we're obviously doing all the on-island stuff and then we're going to do this other stuff. But what works so well is we get a reminder of John Locke at his like best and gentlest self. And so to hear the smoke monster talk about him, and then to see that other reality of him just gets me heated. I am ready for us to shoot this smoke. How are we gonna stop this smoke? I want to stop it now for shit talking John Locke. So that's
burn all your flowers, Joanna, quickly.
Oh, they're all going in the fire.
Maybe you could just shoot an ash bomb at him and he will have to like dissipate, and maybe there's like a mother particle that has the consciousness.
Ew, like kombucha.
Yeah, like kombucha. I was actually thinking or like 10 million ants from Rick and Morty.
Okay.
Has like the queen ant. Anyway, not important. You don't have to watch every show to talk about Lost. You could just watch Lost. All right. With that, with Flock hitting Richard in the neck and picking him up and taking him into the forest.
Carrying him off. I love that he stops to scold everyone else, though. It's
very
just
disappointed.
Very disappointed in all
not,
of you.
I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
Like you all did exactly what I said and followed me here. I'm very disappointed in all of it.
Oh,
it's somewhat confusing and just fun. He's just living his evilest life.
Can I ask you guys a quick question before we leave the island? What if you had to pick like one scene, one moment from this two episodes worth of island stuff? Like, what is the thing that sticks with you?
Me, and then Flock just takes Ricardus down. Like, I really, that's like one of my favorite moments of season six, period.
Okay. And then for you, Neil?
I mean, it's got to be the Juliet and Sawyer scene. Yeah. It's just soul crushing.
I'm with you. Okay. So that's for a reason. There's no wrong answer, but that's for a reason. We'll come back to it.
Yeah. So is mine. No, I just think it's great for a villain to assert dominance over a very powerful character very early on, a la Thanos punching Hulk at the beginning of Infinity War.
No. There's no. I'm saying there's a reason that I asked that, not that your answer was wrong. There's no wrong answer. I just
oh,
there was
I thought
a
you said
was
there was a
that.
Reason that you and Neil both picked the correct answer.
No. There's no wrong answer.
Because we're not antagonists.
There's no wrong answers. We're just going to, I'm going to ask a similar question when we're done with the other part. And then we're going to talk about this final season.
Got it. All right. It's time to talk about the other part where apparently we are back on our original Oceanic Flight 815. with all of our losties, most of our losties, because as we pointed out before, Shannon apparently is not there. And we have plus a Desmond, who was not originally on the flight. But apparently, in whatever's happening here, these people are all bound together on this airplane. And as we see very early on after the opening scene, the island is underwater.
Dun, dun, dun.
This is so fucking fun. Can you do the thing where we talk about what we're going to call this
thing? Yeah, I think that the first question is, what are we going to call
this
thing? So this comes from the official podcast check-in. They released a video podcast 2 days after this episode aired that began with Damon Lindelof, who says, I think the question that Carlton and I get asked the most about this year is, what are you guys going to do this year? You know, you've done the flashbacks, you've done the flash forwards. Are you going to do something different? And we said, yeah, we are, actually, and we're doing these things called Flash Sideways. So we will be referring to them also as Flash Sideways.
Which goes with what I think a lot of folks were calling it at the time, sort of this alternate reality. Like, we don't know exactly where this is or when this is, but it's a sideways world.
Yeah, the title of the show would sort of indicate that they want us to think that, I think, as well.
And, like, I think a common theory is that, like, Juliet hits the bomb and it splits off a different branch of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that seems to
be... In one reality, she blows a hole in the island and it sinks because it's buoyant. And in the other reality, she gets blinked forward to 2007 with everybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, this Flash Sideways thing is so fucking fun. Whatever it is, like, it is, I think it is so fun. Think about who's watching the show at this point. Unlike, we talked about this before, but unlike Game of Thrones, which, like, grew and grew and grew and grew and grew its audience till the final season, Lost a lot of its audience. And so the people who are sticking around at the end here, I mean, it's still, you know, got a sizable audience, but, like, the people who are sticking around at the end here are, like, in it, and they are devoted, and they just get reward after reward in this episode of little references and cute callbacks and fun appearances. And it's just so fun, and it reminds you of where we all started and why we all love the show in the first place, while at the same time having, like, I said this on Twitter earlier today when I was watching this episode, it has the deep emotional resonance of a show that you've been watching for a while. So watching, like, Sawyer's heart break into a million pieces on the bottom of a fucking hole in the ground, that is because you've invested a lot in this character's journey, right? So that's the emotional payoff of many seasons of television. Whilst giving us that, like, new car smell of the, you know, the first season, people are back in their old costumes. We're trying to make their hair look the same, except for Sawyer doesn't really work and Charlie got a haircut. But, like, you know, it's like that old season one feeling. And, like, what a brilliant thing to smash those things together. I love this. I love this episode.
I think it's like, I would describe it even as less new, because even, like, the thing that make alternate reality stories in both, like, drama and action and comedy, I'm thinking of like Fringe or Legends of Tomorrow or, like, Rick and Morty, is that they get better after you know the base characters.
That's true.
Like, that's why it's, like, so much more fun. So not only are there the Easter eggs you're talking about that are rewarding the fans, but I think it works so well because Hurley saying he's the luckiest guy alive and smiling and us getting to see him be happy with that luck is so much more rewarding, having known, you know, the arc of Hugo up to this point, Hurley up to this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
although apparently he only makes Australian chicken commercials in this reality.
It's the, you know, it's the characters that get to come back. Your Boone, Arst is back. Seeing Charlie again, is fun, even though Charlie's having a bad day. And it's the little, I think it starts the way the first episode starts, you would be very forgiven for thinking that this worked, that what they did worked, right? And that whatever Juliet did flashed and everything's fine now. But as different things start happening, like when Desmond shows up.
Yeah, like, that's a big one.
It's creating this slow rolling mystery to where now we're like, all right, well, what the hell actually is going on in this new place, you know? And I think it's so much fun. It's such an adrenaline rush to start the final season with something just so wildly weird.
And even before that, like, I love what you just said, Neil, and even before that moment where you're like, oh, it worked, you get the moment of like, oh, are we seeing what happened before the crash again? Mm-hmm. Like, are we just at the beginning, like, before the crash again? Are they going to crash again?
Wouldn't that be
like,
Jack's luck if his big plan worked and then they crashed again?
They have this big turbulent moment and Matthew Fox does some great face acting and then, like, it's fine. And Bernard makes it back from the bathroom and he missed Rose while he was in the bathroom.
In the conclusion of Lost as a story, Bernard makes it back from the bathroom and everything is fine.
That's the first time I start crying. So when Bernard said he missed Rosalie's in the bathroom.
And I love the gentleness of the sort of montage at the end of the first part.
It
shows Flight 815 landing. And that's one of the ones that catches me off guard, where I'm like, oh, I'm getting very emotional just watching this plane land safely.
The deplaning montage
so good.
Is so powerful. You know, it reminds you of those old, like, beach reunion moments from Lost. Mm-hmm. But it's just, like, really emotional. And, like, and the reveal of each of these characters, right? Like, Desmond just popping up is classic Desmond. What the hell are you doing here? What are you reading? And why do you look great in a suit?
Right.
I have so many questions.
You weren't even on this plane before. What's going on here?
But, like, the pan around shot to the Boone reveal, right? Mm-hmm. The pan around John, and then you get Boone, and then you're like, oh, and hey, Frogert's here, right?
Frogert.
Or the you sort of go, you hear Arse before you see him, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And then the fucking ring being the thing, the first thing you see of Charlie is that stupid ring on his finger. It's so much fun. It's so mm-hmm. fun.
I think the deplaning montage was when I sort of, it clicked into me, like, oh, right, it doesn't, like, the island was really good for some of these characters, because the deplaning montage especially focuses on Charlie getting arrested, mm-hmm. on John getting loaded into his wheelchair, and on Kate getting, like, shuffled off the plane, where it's just like, oh, man, like, not everybody's Sawyer that, like, just got away with murder and is going to be fine, you know? It's all going to be different.
Yeah, you really feel that the sequence, the shots where they land and then the police show up on the plane and you just sort of see Kate's face. It's a reminder that, like, oh shit, right. Kate has to go to jail now.
Yeah.
Because she's still
in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Charlie's in a lot of trouble. But, like, honestly, and I've said this before, I don't know why I get so emotional every time Boone shows up, but when Boone, like, shakes Locke's hand goodbye, that's a lot for me. And then,
like,
I mean,
when he's like, oh, if this plane crashes, I'm gonna stick with you, and it's just like, that's what happened.
You do.
Then you get gooped, buddy. But and then, of course, I mean, yeah, in that deplaning montage, the fact that it's down to Jack and John, and the fact that John, we've seen this before, but the fact that John is, like, we've talked about this before. We don't want to be, like, ableist about this. Obviously, like, you know, being in a chair is not, like, the worst thing that could happen to a person. Obviously, it's not. But, like, for this character, this is a painful, humiliating aspect of travel for him, having to wait to be carried. And Terry O'Quinn is just so good in that vulnerability. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, well, and then I guess we'll follow him off the plane because Kate does action things. He ends up with Jack in lost luggage, and it turns out that Jack's father's body is missing. They thought they loaded it onto the plane. They don't know where it is now. Weird. And Locke's good-naturedly lost his knives, but they both kind of managed to uplift each other. Locke with making a definition between like the being that was Jack's father and just the body that they've lost. And Jack saying that nothing's irreversible and giving Locke that free consult. They could have been friends, guys. Mm-hmm. They could have been friends from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, and you're reminded of the just really excellent chemistry that those two actors have that we haven't seen in a long time.
You know, yeah, they kept punching each other for a couple of seasons there.
Well, and, yeah. And I think what's also true is that I've talked about this plenty in The Storm, but maybe a little bit in The Calm and the finale, where it's like when you find out that it's the Man in Black in John Locke's body, you're sad. Because mm-hmm. if you like the character John Locke, because you're like, oh, I'm glad Terry Quinn's still here and he's doing a lot of great stuff, but I fucking miss John Locke and I really miss him. And so the fact that we get a version of him, whatever this is, John's here in the mm-hmm. final season, and Terry Quinn gets to still play John in the final season, not just this villain. And I think that's a big gift. And I find this scene between Jack and John when he's like, you know, they lost his body, but they didn't lose him. He's not his body. I mean, I just find it very powerful. So, mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, you know, Terry O'Quinn may have done most of season 5 not knowing that he was the Man in Black and the smoke monster in John's body. But in season 6, he very much knew, and he mm-hmm. is playing full on evil. On the island. And I think it's such a wonderful way to balance.
I think his first project right after that, this was the project where he played like the landlord that was literally the devil.
Sure.
So it's like, it's pretty great. This like is some
Park prime Avenue 666 or whatever that was called.
Yeah, yeah. Some prime Terry O'Quinn.
Oh, no.
Those things we found funny before we elected a New York developer president and it all became too real. All right, let's follow the Kwans off the plane. Another couple that might not be in a better place, although they are together, because Jin is old Jin. Jin mm-hmm. has not been island humbled.
Jin still has some bad takes.
He tells some bad takes. And Sun is still keeping her English secret from him. So it seems like that relationship it could go in a good direction. We want to root for them. We know they're capable of great love, and we've seen a lot of their flashbacks from previous seasons. But we have hard Jin back. Joanna, how's this play for you?
It's tough. I mean, Daniel Day Kim, first of all, number one, and a bad wig. It's his season one hair. It's bad. I miss his flowing island locks. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been dying to see the Kwans reunited. And here we get, this is like a little twist of the knife. You're like, oh, you want Sun and Jin back together? Here they are. But he's telling her to button her cardigan again. And you're like, fuck. So yeah, it reminds me actually a little bit of the show Loki that's about to start pretty soon on Disney Plus, where we're getting an earlier Loki who hasn't been through his emotional progress in the MCU, and it's sort of like there's some fun there because then you get to see that arc again. But also, I mean, I feel like they didn't give us like really bad season one Sawyer. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's here and he's like, you know, he's sweetheart and
he didn't call anyone like a terrible nickname.
Yeah, he didn't. There's no racism yet. So
like the Joker, he knows how to live in a society.
So I'm bummed to see the return of Bad Jin.
Yeah.
So we see him whisked off because he's been carrying too much cash for customs. And we will probably have to pick it up there. Let's get...
Sorry, I know. I know we're running late, but like, Jin's watch. What do we know about that? Do we know anything?
So that was the original plan, right? That's like a gift.
Right. And he meets the guy in the bathroom who's like, I work for Mr. Pike and blah, blah, blah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Just needed a refresher on the watch. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. We are with Kate now, who has a most punchable face, Marshall with her, and punches him in the face, or slams that face against the edge of a tile in the bathroom after attempting to pick her cuffs with a pen, it appears like.
That she stole from Jack.
That mm-hmm. she stole from Jack, who I needed love a pen with Charlie.
I love that moment. I mean, it's like three levels, right? Like, we get the little, like, whatever, meet cute-ish with Jack and Kate on the plane. Meanwhile, she's taking the pen that she's going to use to try to pick the lock later. Then we get the failed tricky-otty moment with Charlie, where he's like, I need a pen. And Boone isn't there to find him all the pens, and mm-hmm. he doesn't have his pen on him. So anyway, okay. Sorry, Kate. Back to Kate.
I mean, it is very neat, but also this episode has the Ankh and the muddy water in it. So, like, you know, it giveth okay. and taketh with construction.
Okay. Like an Ankh.
Kate runs out through an airport. What airport is that, Joanna? Is that LAX? You live close to LAX.
100% the Oahu airport. She looks up through this, like, stone walkway area to see a palm tree. And I just, like, love how every time they shoot a palm tree, they're like, that looks like LA, right, guys? And I'm like, no, the palm trees in Hawaii look different from the palm trees in LA. Like, I don't know. Maybe they don't look that different to you guys. But to me, like, I have a huge palm tree in my backyard, actually. The ones in Hawaii are more curved. They, like, blow in the breeze. They look tropical. That's not a California palm tree. Anyway, it's the Oahu airport. I've been there many times.
And then Kate gets saved by a very smooth Sawyer in a elevator move and scene that is very fun to watch in terms of Sawyer scenes, because it's not sad. Gets one over on the airport police. She rushes out, jumps in a cab, and there's Claire. Claire's back, Claire. Guys.
I'm going to give this wig 7 out of 10. It's this definitely, is definitely not the worst wig we've seen, Claire.
Definitely not the worst wig.
So that, I think, it means that we'll probably be guessing from that next week's episode is called What Kate Does. I'm guessing that's where we're going to pick her up, which means Emily Draven's back, everybody. Back on Lost.
Right.
We did miss her after she was left in the cabin that we now think might not have been a great sign. But at least over here in the sideways, she's, oh, I don't know. Kate's not going to hurt her. I feel comfortable knowing enough Kate about I mean, Kate than that.
Yeah, so far,
always. Like, weird stuff going on. Like, Hurley's like, I'm the luckiest guy in the world, mm-hmm. which we know is not true of Hurley, right? So, like, what's going on? Shannon stayed in Australia. Well,
and
Desmond's
I said that
there.
Sawyer just got away with murder, but I don't actually know the if this
that's
is
where
like,
he was
he
in
really
the
happy.
Original flight 815.
Right.
He seems very chill now. He, like we pointed out earlier, has not said anything racist yet. So that's a big one. Although Kate, very familiar for Kate to take off running.
Yes, so, that seems
pretty on brand. She seems pretty normal.
I think she says to the marshal, I'm not gonna, what am I gonna do, stab you and run? And I'm like, yes, Kate, that's exactly, of course, that's exactly what you're gonna do, dear. Yeah.
Just not on the airplane. You just had to count to 5,000 and then I was gonna do it. All right, what I'm anticipating here, what's the biggest change? And then I'm going to throw it at Joanna's, I'm guessing, best memory question. What do we think the biggest change that you guys spotted was? I think mine is still Hurley, because it's like literally the opposite. It's not like a little tweak. It's like black mm-hmm. is white for Hurley in terms of luck.
Oh, I have a good one for this.
Yeah, go for it.
So you remember how in the first five seasons, the island itself was above the water.
Uh-huh.
And you could see it from like a boat or a plane.
Yeah.
In this season, in this sideways, it's on the bottom of the ocean, which is a very weird place for the island to be.
Can we talk about the polygons in that sequence?
Sure.
Yeah. How do we feel about the shark?
Yeah, Dave.
I mean, the shark, not great about. I think the smartest thing they did was, even though we're underwater, the camera still travels very low to the ground through the brush for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, you're just using that to transition in between your underwater Otterton model and your foot model. The shark looks almost like they added it after the fact. Someone was like, what if we put that Dharma shark that only people who had the capability to pause with TiVo when it aired noticed?
Yeah,
We just throw it in the beginning of season 6 when everybody's thinking that we're going to have answers. Why don't we just throw in that shark?
Just put the shark in there. It's fine.
It looks like a completely different render to everything else around it.
Okay, I have one.
Yeah.
You know how way back when Flight 815 was up in the air, Desmond was down in a hatch pushing a button? Well, glory be, now he's up in the air on that flight. I don't know what's happening, but I would like to know.
Apparently, you know, things as far back as 1977 could be different. So, like, it's a whole new ballgame in Sideways Universe.
I'm delighted by Charlie's haircut. I just need to say that really quickly. I'm not sure if Cindy's new hair, temple hair, or Charlie's hair is better, but, like...
Oh, Charlie's Dominic, hair, for sure.
Dominic Monaghan was just, like, sort of clinging to, like, this scraggly blonde hair look for way too long. It never did him any favors. And this clean cut, being honest about our hairline moment for him is, it looks great. He looks great, even though he's kind of blue when we see him. Also, when the bag of heroin emerged, I definitely said out loud, "Now that's something I haven't seen in years." So welcome back, bag of heroin.
Oh, hello, bag of heroin. You're back once again.
Here we are again. Yeah.
Haven't seen you but 50 statues ago. all right. I think then with Joanna's question. Oh, wait, no. One thing. Joanna. There are things we're supposed to be looking for as we're moving forward in these sideways.
We had a little pre-chat about whether or not this is a spoiler, and I don't think it is. But I would say if you're watching this for the first time, or maybe you're watching it again and you weren't like a close watcher, please, or I just think it's fun to pay attention to mirror / reflection shots. So Jack takes a long look at himself in the bathroom mirror on the flight when he goes to the bathroom. I think Kate looks at herself in the mirror. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Jack definitely does. So just enjoy those moments. Maybe have a drink, have a sip. If you see a character stop and look at themselves in the reflection of something, as we go through the season.
And then do we have to pick a best moment from the flash sideways?
Yep.
My inner imp says I should also go with the person getting the crap beat out of them in that one.
But
that's not actually my favorite, just because it's like a brutal like forehead slam. I have to pick the good one, right? Rose and Bernard get to be together and be happy, and seeing that they would have been happy whether they were on the island or off the island is very nice to me.
All right, Neil, what's yours?
Well, I was going to say the moment where Rose tells Jack he can let go, but I don't want it. This doesn't all have to be Rose and Bernard. They're great. So I really think that it's the moment where Saeed shows up and just kicks in the bathroom
door.
Man of action style.
Maybe I could be of service.
Right? Because at this point, I think he had already, like, as you're watching the episode, we'd already watched Saeed die, right? Like, he had already drowned by then.
Maybe. But at any rate, he's, like, looking very poorly, and you're like, oh, my God, Saeed. And then you're like, oh, Saeed!
It's like, Saeed's going to die.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that he shows up in the sideways and immediately just does cool shit.
So, you know, as we go into this, the reason I'm asking you these questions, and it's just something that I want us to all think about as we go into this final season, is like, you know, this final season, the finale of Lost, is notoriously a divisive one. Notoriously, a lot of people had some issues with it. Something Damon Lindelof said to me recently. I don't think it was made it into the interview that we published, but he said something to me about how, I think it's okay for me to say, he was like, something we did in the final season is that we really pivoted to caring so much more about the characters and the emotion than we did the resolution of a mystery. Mm-hmm. And it was maybe too late in the game to make that pivot. And maybe it was like too hard. And that's what was jarring for people. And like, not that character and emotion hasn't always been an important part of Lost, but it's sort of like, it's been like, let's say if it's balanced scale, maybe they really put their thumb on the character emotion part in the final season. And then if you've watched other Lindelof joints, that's classic Lindelof, right? Let the mystery be, but care about the emotion stuff. So for me, trying to like keep that in mind, for me, what I latched to on Island is Sawyer and Juliet. For me, what I latched to in this Sideways thing is, for me, it's Jack and John and their conversation about Christian. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I just want our calm watchers to have the best experience possible in this. And so I would just say, look for those character beats, you know, and hang on to them, or not. You do you. You watch it however you want. And if you're, you know, Dave, and you want to watch people get punched in the face, that's great too. So, you
know. Also, we're still going to have plenty of time on this podcast to make fun of all the questions that they don't answer.
Yeah, that's
true. Don't worry, we will walk you through those as well.
We will.
All right, I think that means it is time to get to the corners for LAX part 1 and 2. Neil, we have quite the Giacchino corner this week.
Yeah. I promise in season 6 that I will heed the requests of some of our listeners and do some more deep dives into individual tracks and what Giacchino is doing. However, as with the previous episode, the season 5 finale, there is just a massive list of ridiculous titles that I would like to read off to you. And then we're going to do a choose your fighter thing. You just get to choose your favorite. These are the tracks that are on the season 6 soundtrack from this episode. Number 1 is A Sunken Feeling. And it feels like it's about the statue. Heavy Metal Crew. I actually don't know what that one's all about. Doing Jacob's Work.
Oh, a heavy metal crew has to be like pulling the metal off.
Oh, right.
Off of
when
Juliet.
They're pulling the metal off Juliet. Okay. We have Smokey and the Bandits, which that's a fun one. LAX with No Space, which is actually really just the Oahu airport. Temple and Spring, which you'll remember that the spring is what they call that muddy pool. Lock at It This Way.
Oh, no.
Richard and the Floored, which I believe is when Richard's getting punched in the throat. Sorry, Richard.
Very memorable moment.
Coffin Calamity, which a tough moment for Ben there, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Lie Thou There, which is really hard to say. Trouble Is My First Name. That's another one I don't...
That's got to be Kate or something. Right? Kate and Sawyer in the elevator or something like
that. Yeah. Death Springs Eternal, which is, I think, about our guy Saeed. And The Rocket's Red Glare, which is, again, about the dumbest rocket trebuchet configuration,
bamboo,
all made out of wood for some god awful reason.
I hate that temple. I did actually try to make some musical cue notes as mm-hmm. I went through the episode. So like Doing Jacob's Work is next to a note in my notes that says, oh my fucking god, it's Jacob, his little wave. And I think it's like Jacob's theme kicks in, and so right. I have to imagine that that's what that is. And then there's this musical cue that I think is A Sunken Feeling, which happens sort of anytime someone says something that, so when Hurley says, I'm the luckiest man alive, it's almost like a Twilight Zone. It's almost like a, mm-hmm. like, so when Hurley says, I'm the luckiest man alive or whatever he says, and it's the same music that plays when it goes down underwater to the polygon mess. So I really liked that. If I had to pick one, I would say A Sunken Feeling, that Twilight Zone music.
Yeah. Dave, any that you like?
Apparently Richard the Floored
Yeah. And I think I don't remember the music from the sequence. I'm too busy just intensely anticipating the death of Brahm to notice the music. But I think the Smokey and the Bandits one, I like that name. That's good. That's a fun one.
I'm so happy Brahm's dead.
I mean,
rest in pieces.
I don't mind that Alana's still around. Like, let's learn more about Alana. But like those other dudes, I'm good.
Yeah.
Our jungle of mystery moment is, why is the island underwater?
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. All right. A returning favorite category. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to the marshal, who gets a head slam and then falls down.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like quite a head slam. And he has one of those passing outs where you're moaning during it, which just seems like the worst.
I love that. I mean, Kate, she's good.
She's like, to the other women.
He attacked me. I gotta go.
Yeah, and I mean, this still, as far as we can tell, this is still a better fate for the marshal than what happened in the plane crash. Because that guy really, really had a bad time.
Remember when Sawyer doesn't kill him? Oh, no.
The new corner coming up is the John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award. It's when a character that we haven't seen for a while because they're probably dead comes back. This goes to Boone this week.
Mm-hmm.
Boone!
I was like, can we call it the Boone Carlisle Memorial? And they're like, Joanna, you can't name every award after Boone Carlisle. And I was like,
Boone
okay.
Carlisle. One season, all the named awards.
But yeah, I guess, and this is sort of like which returning character gets sort of the best moment. And I agree with Joanna that moment, the whole conversation with Boone and Locke is great. They're giving great performances. The fact that Frogert is in there as well, just sleeping away, is delightful. It's the whole thing just works.
The Guess I'm Out of a Book Club. Joanna, we have two entries this week.
Yes. There is the, oh God, what was his name? The awful French guy we didn't like. Jean-Pierre? I don't know. That's
Armless Jean-Pierre.
Takes the time to note that he's reading Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. And I love how Jin was like, I've been here before. I know what's happening here. I have all the French people answering.
I know he had a book. That guy sucked.
Chester Copperpot. What is he doing down here? And then Desmond is on the plane. He is not reading Charles Dickens. He's reading Salman Rushdie's Haroun and the Sea of Stories. So there you go. That's our book club for now. I mean, I suppose you could read a lot into... Well,
what those
Haroun,
books are.
Haroun is a variant of the Hebrew name Aaron, so that's fun. And Haroun, the main protagonist, this is from Lostpedia, of course. The Haroun, the main protagonist, spends most of the novel in a story world called Kahani that has characters and issues similar to Haroun's real world at the end of the novel. The reader is left to wonder whether Kahani was real or a dream, and what the strange changes in his real world, a result of his visits to Kahani, or mere coincidence. So that's a fun question, and I bet many copies of Haroun and the Sea of Stories sold after the Losties saw Desmond reading it. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much Kierkegaard, but perhaps.
We have another corner around the corner here. It's the Abs Eterno Award, which will make sense later in the season. But don't worry about it. If you're a rewatcher, you get it. It goes to some hot abs. This is going to replace our Saidra button watch. Because they drowned him and took away our enthusiasm for tracking those buttons. But it does not go to Saeed this week. Instead, it goes to Jin, who gets a costume switch, the temple, and it's a very tight white shirt.
Very confident white
Jin's
t-shirt.
Been looking good.
Yeah, this is like, this is just a who's looking hot this week award, mm-hmm. because there's plenty Abs of people looking hot in season 6. They knew.
The Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. It comes back because Ben's still here, and it's Ben saying, well, of course Jacob's all right. They're both together inside. John just wants to talk to you.
I knew that's, like, as soon as he said that, I'm like, oh, that's winning the award. Fucking, Ben just, like, walks out lying. I love him. Yeah. Love
he
you,
still
Ben.
Got it. Even after suffering the horrific trauma of killing his own god, Ben is still just lying, just comes right back to him, like riding him.
Yeah,
bike.
And even when it doesn't seem like it'd be beneficial to lie, like, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess he did stab Jacob, so like it would yeah. be a lot of questions, but Ben, like, Ben dead and locks him there.
Somehow, it and what I like about it is that it immediately things get worse, because then Richard's like, oh, really? Like, let me show you John's dead body over here. And Ben's like, shit. Do you think he...
How many times could this rug be pulled out from under me?
Do you think Ben ever connects? Like, maybe if I don't lie, things will get better?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, it seems like it's just he's better at lying than he mm-hmm. is at telling the truth.
For sure.
Hard truths from Ben are clumsy truths. All right, the woo-loo-loo best time travel moment is still around. Maybe this might be the last week for it. We don't know if we're traveling through any more time. But Hurley, who says, I carried that case across the ocean through time, because time case pays off with Ankh.
Such a disrespectful move, too, to just crack the Ankh in half. Like, what is going on here?
He carried it across the ocean and through time.
You gotta respect the Ankh.
All right, Jungle of Kistri, let me explain, is going to work a little differently now that we are doing our episodes on Saturdays, dropping the episodes on Saturdays after our live watch. So we no longer have like the this week's Kistri on the podcast. What we will do instead is during that live watch, we will collect your suggestions and we will do a Twitter poll and we will read the results of the previous week on the week podcast. So you our listeners who are live watching with us will still get to nominate the Kistri thing. We're going to shoot that poll right up on Twitter, like right after the live watch, with your fresh ideas for Kistri. And then every week we will read the results. So here are the results from the incident. Coming in last, Richard and Locke. Oh, well. Mm-hmm. Coming in second and last, Jack and Sawyer. They were punching. It was 3 weeks ago. You may not recall, but they were punching each other a lot. Only 18.4%. So that was 10%, 16.4%. Only 18.4% of the vote went to the rock and the bomb.
Which is not a terrible showing for two inanimate objects.
I don't know. Juliet, like, went to so much effort to make that work. I thought it was going to do better, but running away with it, and we can't be surprised. It's our jungle retirees, Vincent's new parents, Rose and Bernard, with 55.2% of the vote. Juliet should have stayed and had that mm-hmm. cup of tea with them. That's what I think. So yeah. I wonder if they got blown into a tree this last time jump.
I hope not. Yeah. I hope they were touching their hut because they spent a lot of time on it.
That's so true.
That would be so terrible if they.
I hoped their tea just like jostled slightly and that was it.
They're like, oh, it's night now. And they're like, that's odd.
And they're like, oh, it's Jack and those assholes again.
Think Jack blew up that bomb? Who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award can finally go to Juliet this week with, I have to tell you something. It's really, really important.
It worked.
That's not our actual final words.
I'm doing the ghost part. It worked.
But we are going to declare her dead and give her that award because she definitely gets buried, which is pretty dead, unless you're Nikki and Paolo. The Frank Lapidus, guess we're not going to Guam Act Break Award, goes to Locke. Says, I'm sorry you had to see me like that. Making sure that everybody knows he is the smoke monster.
So fucking funny.
Yeah, no ambiguity there, which I like. I like how very clearly this episode spells out some stuff right here mm-hmm. at the beginning of the season.
And with that, we are going to move into the storm right after this.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Like, I don't know, you're living parallel lives, half on an island and half on an airplane? Listen, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist who will be at least better than Harper. We can definitely guarantee that. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. This is professional counseling done securely online. And listen, there's a broad range of expertise available. Crisis counseling, anything you might possibly need to handle either the extremities of the show Lost we're watching, but also the realities of living in 2021. It is a tough time.
We could all use some help. And you can get the expertise of some folks who might not be locally available in many areas. And the service BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide.
You could log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, and then you'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you could schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available because BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
So here's what you're going to want to do. If you want to know more, you're going to visit their website and you're going to read testimonials that are posted daily about different counselors. Here's one example. This is about a counselor named Gail. Gail is as solid as an actual rock. She helps me incredibly with her steady, gentle, practical guidance. I feel very grateful to have her support in navigating the turbulence of my everyday life. That sounds delightful. Visit BetterHelp.com/storm. That's Better H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. This week's podcast episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. And the Storm listeners can get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/storm.
All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council subscribers. They are folks who joined at the $10 level or above. We got a bunch of new folks, partially because we haven't done this for a couple weeks. So here we go. Many thanks to TLC, Jacqueline Ellis, or Jacqueline, John Replinger, Emily Burr, Grace Robertson, Diego de los Reyes, David Dillon, Patrick Maloney, Kyle M., Scott Karnitz, Cat just stepped on the mouse and everything went away. Clifford Robinson, Emily Riff Riff. I really hope your name is Emily Riff Riff, and that's actually it. Moonbeam Bell, Carolyn, Lori Bonar, Shannon Black, Isabel Hazel, Roundtree Jones, Tiffany Flowers, Dan Allen, Christina Brocious, Rachel Fisher Bramble, Monty Cross, Susan Kutzich, Spencer Howard, Susan P., Amy Meek, Lovely, Miss Jenna, Clark Ainsley, Rebecca, and Natalie Oliva. Something tells me I got more than I was supposed to.
And I would like to thank Mariana Cotto, Jeffrey D. Kurtz, Kristen Smith, Jenna Jardine, Denise Sheridan, Seth Bollock, Patrick Wayne, Herman Crondale, Stuart Wynn, Erica Sonstrom, EW, Nicole Havelka, Fahim Ibrahim, Lauren Galbraith, Ryan Casas, Suniva Asgard, Christopher Mack, James DeVores, Malik Birkenfeld, Electric Sheep TV, and Michael Lisi. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Ashley Lopez, James, Matt Gray, J.P. Gagan, C.J., Trish, Anthony Mamo, Cameron Karis Sconyers, all right, Erica Kremenak, Mike Munzer, Jennifer Carnavale, Alejandro Pozos, Sarah Finnemore, Damon Van Vuren, Josh, Mary Henderson, Seth Freilich, what's up, Seth? Jessica Scott, Matthew Wilson, Sarah Cooper. Thank you all for being members of the Small Council.
And we are back for the storm. Go ahead.
Pew, pew, pew.
Pew, 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 pew. We're here. The energy's high. We're finally in the final season. This storm section, I imagine, is going to slowly start reducing like an accordion. But probably not this week, because there's stuff in this episode that is much more interesting if you know they're all dead and trying to find themselves, living their best lives. specifically, I would like to start with, before I hand off to Joanna, who has a lot of excellent notes. Why is the Dharma shark in heaven?
Yeah.
The Dharma shark has his own flash sideways. Because you know how there are people in the flash sideways who are not in the church, like Eloise.
Oh, they're not ready yet.
They're not ready yet.
The shark's not ready
yet. The shark, and here's the thing, the shark can't move on until it finds Mikhail.
Mikhail. 1,000%. The shark and Mikhail are in a bonded pod, heaven pod together. I hope you don't feel like I stepped on your punchline.
Nope.
I was just like, heels going exactly where I hope he
is. Great minds, as they say.
So Mikhail needs to stop writing his book and playing chess in his woodland cabin, wherever he is in this timeline, and get down there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're eventually going to see him. He's going to show up and do some translating for Kimi.
Yes.
The Sun and Jin.
And he has both eyes, doesn't he?
Maybe.
I think he does.
Maybe.
I think he loses. I think like Jin takes his eye or something. Like, you know what
Jin
I mean?
Jin takes
like,
his eye.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'll talk about it. Yeah, what was your theory? Do you remember your theory before we started recording many hours ago, Dave, about why?
Oh, my theory was, if this is like manifested in the like people that were important to you in island time got like drawn into it, that the only person who would even know about the Dharma shark would be Sawyer. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like Sawyer somehow Stay Puft Marshmallow Man the shark into the sideways heaven reality.
I just thought about the worst thing I could possibly imagine. The Dharma shark. I don't know why Sawyer's like kind of Matthew McConaughey in my head, but speaking of, I mean, this doesn't really belong in the storm, but like it's hilarious for them to try to put Josh Holloway back in his season one look where they hadn't figured out what looked good on Josh Holloway yet. So he's in the like double layer T look and you're like, that's not your look, buddy. Get you a button down. Okay.
You guys remember 2004?
Something I want to talk about are a few things that we know are different that make this episode more fun to watch. Number one is the fact that Sawyer has not just shot someone in Australia. He is in fact a cop. And so when things get, you know, when trouble starts to brewing on the plane with Charlie, he's like, what's going on? Like in a sort of cop way of like, and the fact that he's helping Kate in the elevator against the other, I mean, that's just more fun, right?
Cause yes, he's definitely.
He's a cop helping her because he thinks she's cute and he thinks it's funny to watch this fugitive on the run, I guess.
He's not a great cop.
Not a great cop.
But that's okay.
All cops are bastards, and some of them are
cop,
Sawyer.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's not...
Great cop is oxymoron.
He's not effective as a cop, necessarily. He's still got his own life going on.
And then let's talk about Sun. Dave, do you recall what's going on with Sun in this Flash Sideways?
I don't recall what's going on with Sun in this Flash Sideways. I haven't gone any deeper in these two episodes yet.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were just playing it up in the comm or what, but Sun actually doesn't speak English in this Flash Sideways. So she's not lying when the person's like, you know, it'd be really great if you could speak English right now. And she's like, no English. That's for real. Sun can't speak English.
Yeah, I tried to mix up like we had actually started over and knew some things. In the calm, we'll see how I go going forward.
Do you remember about Jack's injury?
How he got the neck cut?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Neil, what do you know?
You know, this is one I don't remember. I know the stuff about Sun and Jin and how their relationship is a little different because they're not married. That's the other thing.
Yes, that's the other thing. They're lovers on the
in
run.
The sideways. Yeah. But it's interesting because I sort of missed the Jack's cut thing several times on these rewatches, so I am now furiously trying to remember what that was, but I don't.
So it's like it's a wound that he gets, I believe, in the final fight, like in the finale.
He's
bleeding from his neck, at the end of his life, and so this wound that he has on his neck that like doesn't really heal throughout this season. This mysterious, like, how did I get that? It kind of looks like a shaving cut, you know, so you could kind of think it's that, but it's this like wound from his death that keeps bleeding, is my memory throughout the season. Mm-hmm. So
bleeding through.
Mm.
Like how Juliet lives the moment.
Yeah. So what's going on there in your opinion, Dave?
So she's sort of like flitting into death, and it, as she is, because I'm assuming the afterlife is nonlinear and time works differently, she's living the moment where she meets Sawyer again. So like they kind of only say we could go Dutch once in a heaven.
She's having a real Charlotte, I'm not allowed to have chocolate before dinner moment, right? Where she's like speaking something from elsewhere in her timeline. But this timeline is a afterlife timeline. And also, Neil, what does she mean by it worked? What does that mean?
Well, it worked. Oh, God. My mind is drawing a blank. But it worked in the sense that they get, like they will meet again, right? And that it worked in the sense that, I don't know.
I don't mean this is a pop quiz. I think this is kind of ambiguous. Like, yeah. What happens when Juliet hitting the bomb have anything to do with this afterlife creation thing? Or is it completely unrelated and all the bomb does is jostle them back into the same timeline as everyone else?
I mean, I definitely think the show wants us to believe that this incident is what sort of causes it to split. I think Juliet, when she's blipping back and forth between the afterlife and here, she ultimately realizes that Sawyer does eventually get off the island and get to go home. And that was what she wanted to do in the first place. So I think to that extent, it does actually work. Like she still has to die, but it saves Sawyer. He goes on to live whatever life he goes on to live. And then they ultimately meet again in the afterlife, which is lovely.
Yeah. We get like a lot of the dialogue, like, you got it, Blondie. Like, it's not just Juliet's dialogue, because Sawyer's dialogue is also what he says mm-hmm. in the vending machine scene. And I think she also says the "it worked" thing in that scene as well. I'm just not clear. I don't think it's ever – and please, host at stormpodcast.com if you know the answer. But I don't know that it's ever confirmed, unless the creators confirmed it outside of the show, that it's hitting Jughead created this bubble sure. for them.
Isn't like, it worked them getting the candy bar out of the machine?
I don't think she says that. But maybe it is.
I mean, either that or it's just, you know, the show would like us to think that they've made an alternate timeline, but the reality is Juliet doesn't know afterlife from a different mm-hmm. timeline, because why would you? Why would anybody?
Sure. Yeah, and I think the show goes very deep into season 6 with this idea that these are two parallel timelines, parallel universes, right? It's not until the very, like, well after, like, the last couple episodes that people start, like, waking up, quote-unquote, in the sideways. So, you know, it could just be there to throw more fuel on the fire of... You know, the alternate reality was created by the incident, and everyone gets to go on and live a happy life there, which we know because we've seen season 6 is not necessarily true. Not everyone's having a good time in the flash sideways. And then eventually they all wake up.
Yeah, can wait till we get to the final David. It's going to be so confusing.
He's coming up. The final David.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just the vending machine worked, and that's all she means. But it mm-hmm. is, and then it is also putting us in a position where we're like, is this alternative universe something that Juliet created? And that's great. We have to wait a long, thank you, V. We have to wait a long time before we see Juliet again in the flash sideways. It's a long wait. Why does Jacob say to Hurley, "I need you to save Saeed"? Like, why does Saeed have to be saved, Dave?
He's a candidate.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only reason.
I think there's a little bit more to it. In that, like, even though we're seeing like a very calm version of Jacob, there is like this panicked post-death version of Jacob who's like, oh shit. Mm-hmm. The man in black, my brother, found the loophole. I now need as many different people who might be able to kill him as possible. Because at one point, Saeed, you know, this is how it ends poorly for Saeed, is like he's going to go try and kill, you know, Flock. And so it's like Jacob being like, Saeed's the most capable person. The most capable killer on this island, you know.
He's very
the
good.
Show has not been telling us that Saeed is the most effective killer for 5 seasons. So you know, Jacob's fully bought into that, I think, and he's like, "Shit, if we lose Saeed, what are we going to have Jack do it?
What are you going to have Hurley, who can't even get the safety off the gun? I've got a gun. Right? I know how to use it.
I know how to shoot it.
I know how to shoot it. I mean, I'm sure that Jacob wants as many candidates as possible to be alive because that gives better odds.
Game. Yeah.
That someone's going to, but it just seems like he's been less invested in protecting any of the other candidates. So yeah, maybe it's just sort of like, okay, we're in the end game now. I need as many candidates to be alive as possible in general. Or maybe
if he dies and you show up with this Ankh and there's one missing person, I'm going to look like an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing is, like, Dojin and Lennon's like, we're in a lot of trouble if he dies. And I'm like, what happens when he dies? Nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or maybe Jacob can see that that Saeed would wind up like an agent of Flock, which is what he becomes. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. That, like, Jacob had to have a ton of forethought. Because if he did, he'd be like, take up to the temple, but also I made the water muddy because I'm dead, so it's not going to work. You know, like.
I have questions. I have a lot of questions, and they all circle back to that stupid temple. All right. Neil, what do you think of the work done in this episode to set us up for Hurley being ultimately the man in charge?
Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, we've talked about it, how it's been something that they've been working in for a while now, you know, since they sort of knew the end point. There are these moments where Hurley shows up and is the most, ultimately the most capable leader. And this is really good because we're starting to see him like fully take charge. Because in season 6, it's not just about convincing, you know, the audience that Hurley is capable of leading. I think a lot of it has to do with Hurley's relationship to Jack. There's a lot of Hurley and Jack stuff in season 6. So it's about ultimately convincing Jack, who's the one who gives him the power at the end. So I think they're off to a great start. Hurley's arc in season 6. I mean, there's never enough Hurley in this show, but mm-hmm. it's a really great, they close that character's arc really great in a really great way.
What do you think, Dave?
I like it. I like Neil saying, always more Hurley. But it's still something that's very believable, but he never has to elevate the way he's speaking. He gets still cool and dude all around. But I also feel like a leadership that has sort of come about in him since he decided that Sawyer was going to be the leader. But like, he knows the qualities, and it isn't until he feels like a certain amount of self-confidence, in this case with Ghost God telling you what to do, that he's able to like step forward and take the leadership role. So in some ways I mostly agree with Neil that it's about his relationship to Jack, but I also think it's a little bit about Hurley being fully confident in himself this mm-hmm. season.
Yeah, because he has this line where he says, can you fix Saeed, Jack? And then Jack's like, no. And then he says, then you're just gonna have to let me do it. Which is just not, like, we get this flashback to season 1 Hurley when he's like, he's sitting with Saeed and Saeed's bleeding, and Hurley does like the gag thing, which is what he did back in season 1, right, about the blood. We know that he can't handle blood, but at the same time he's just sort of like, all right, I got to do it. You know, mm-hmm. like, it's got to be me. And that's not something I see season one Hurley, and until something like The Numbers, right? We see that when Hurley's like, I'm gonna go get some fucking dynamite, and that's what's gonna happen. You know, that's increasingly sort of his attitude. The fact that, like, you know, Dojin seems to recognize that in Hurley. Hurley is, I mean, Dojin will talk to Jack. That will also happen, but like the fact that he called Hurley into the principal's office first is super interesting.
Because he's been carrying around the Ankh.
I mean, you gotta love that Ankh. Do you? Do you? All right. We're gonna circle back to my favorite question. Is the smoke monster corporeal? What's happening? Yes, no, maybe so. Like, he can karate chop Richard in the throat, or whatever. It's not a karate chop. He punches Richard in the throat. But he ducks when the shooting starts. And we see that the bullets, like, sort of crumpled off of him. But, like, did they crumple off of him, or did they crumple off the smoke? At what point is he vulnerable / invulnerable? What do you have, Neil?
Well, I think that there's definitely, because there's also more stuff coming where I think there's like the scene where Saeed stabs him and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's sort of this flexible based on his, like, what he wants to be sort of thing, which is a very cool superpower to have, like to be able to just like someone shoots at you and the bullet just goes right through because you can like spread out your matter. But there will obviously come a point where he becomes fully corporeal and can be punchified to death by Jack.
I think that's after they drain the water from right. the Golden
They're gonna
Cave,
have to
right?
Use the stupid plug, the island's plug. But I like this. I like this addition to the character because it's not just an evil guy in an evil godlike figure in John Locke's body. It is an evil godlike figure that can shapeshift and cannot be easily killed. So, you know, it sets off the entire sort of momentum of the island storyline, which is how do we friggin' kill this guy before he gets off the island and turns everything to shit?
There's that interesting moment in when they send Saeed to stab Locke where I forget who instructs – is Dojin, right? Like, I forget who instructs him, but mm-hmm. it's basically like – don't let him speak. The moment you let him speak, you've already lost, exactly. right? And then he gets a word in before Saeed stabs him. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, was that literal or like what? I have questions about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's this like classic idea of the devil, this very persuasive yeah. force who if you hear him out, he's going to make you do something that you don't want to do or wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah. You know? So that's why it's kind great. Of interesting that it doesn't really work on Sawyer. We'll talk about that.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Dave, does the smoke monster, does Flock, does he lie? We've talked about this before.
I think he does.
Okay. Do you mean he's lying to Ben when he talked about what John Locke was thinking at the end of his life?
John Locke died off island. But John Locke was also on island long enough that Smoke Monster would know how to, like, impersonate John Locke. It's like, I can't remember Christian Shepherd specifically talking about stuff that happened in Jack's past. He just looks like Christian Shepherd and is like, I'm your father. So I don't know, like, the Smoke Monster being able to know somebody's off-island thoughts is, like, maybe too close to Miles. It's either something like Miles or he's fucking omnipotent, like how he was able to appear Christian Shepherd throughout time and know to send John Locke forward and that everybody had to come back. You know, it's one of those, if he doesn't lie, which I agree on paper makes him a much more compelling antagonist because he's going to use, you know, the version of the truth against you to make you do things. That would be a really cool narrative trick. I just don't know if he doesn't need that.
You know,
whether or not he's saying lies, he's saying exactly the right thing to manipulate Ben in that moment. And that's almost scarier, is having that skill to know that.
What's interesting is that I don't think I've ever considered that he was lying about the John Locke, like John's final thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like to me, that always read as like when he took over John's body. So like, we have to assume that when Ajira 316 came rolling onto the island.
When Lapidus landed it like a pro.
Like a pro. Frank with his button-down shirt, looking great, feeling great, landing the plane. A copy was made, right? Like, so it's like the smoke monster is able to basically do a full copy of John. And with that would have come John's memories. So I believe that it's possible that the man in black knew everything that John Locke knew. Because if he has somehow copied him, you know, and also, you know, he's a godlike figure. He can do that, right?
I mean, I guess he
says something like that. I believe he says something like, the longer I'm in this body, the more, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Doesn't he say something like that, Neil? Like, the long, he's like, the more he kind of becomes John.
Yeah.
Not really close to John, but he's just sort of like the memories, the depression that John experiences, life, all this sort of stuff sort of comes creeping in mm-hmm. to the man in black. And then he's like, and then he talks shit on John, and Jack's like, you disrespect his memory. And I'm like, I love you, Jack, for the first time.
Like the smoke monster scanned John, like he scanned, you know, like Echo mm-hmm. or whatever. So presumably, like, he would have memories up to there. My question is it feasible, given what we know about the island's powers, that the smoke monster's trapped on it, that he would have been able to mine that?
Yeah, because all of the people that we believe the smoke monster to have impersonated, their bodies are on the island. Christian Shepherd's body is on the island.
He has a little sprinkling of the miles where he could...
Yemi's body was in the plane.
Wasn't there one who's not... Oh, never mind. I don't want to get into...
The questionable one was Ben's mom, which, yeah. I mean, that... may not have been the smoke monster.
I don't know.
That could have just been Ben's weird brain playing tricks on him or something. I don't know.
Richard's like, you saw who? All right. Here's the last thing that I want to talk about. And by the way, if you have answers to all these questions, you know, like Neil and I rewatched the last season recently. Dave is coming into it fresh. We're all going to be talking about it and refreshing our own memories as we go. If you have answers to the questions we've asked, host@stormpodcast.com is a great place to find us. We do have emails. We've gone on so long in this episode already, though, so I'm not going to read any Storm emails, but we'll definitely read some next week. But this is the last thing I want to talk about, which is this came actually from one of our followers on Twitter was talking about this, which he likened Terry O'Quinn's performance in this final season to Mark Hamill in The Last Jedi, because apparently, and I haven't double-checked this, but according to this listener, Terry O'Quinn gave a bunch of interviews after Lost is over saying, like, he didn't really agree with, you know, what the writing was. I think he wanted to play John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not the smoke monster, but that he does an incredible job as the smoke monster anyway. And it's sort of like how Mark Hamill talked a lot of shit on The Last Jedi, but Mark Hamill was incredible in The Last Jedi. So I guess I'll ask Dave, our most resident Star Wars nerd, do you think that's an apt comparison?
Yeah, probably. I think so. I also think really soon after Lost aired, it would have been very fashionable to say I wasn't a big fan of where that final season went and kind of get away scot-free if you're one of the main, you know, cast members. So I'm not surprised that he did that, but I'm trying to think. I don't recall feeling it, you know, like you said, he does a great job playing Flock, and he does a good job, I think, off island from what I could remember, especially from the waking up stuff. So yes, I think that's accurate in terms of the Mark Hamill parallel, because I think Mark Hamill also, after like seeing some of the reaction, was like, hey, I wasn't really into this, and now has like kind of stopped saying that. Like, he said that once, and he knows that that logs into the brains of people who are important. It's important too. But everybody else still has the work. And so that's kind of like, we still got it. We still got Locke. And is he an antagonist? I guess not. I guess for 5 seasons, he's not an antagonist. And now he is an antagonist. But hey, we get to go through that journey. And it's pretty great.
The antagonist definitely wears his body as a suit.
That's true. But in terms of like, direct like Luke to Locke stuff. Like this might be more satisfying. Just because whether or not this is Locke having him be the antagonist on the island and having him be basically fine after death, reunited with everybody in a non-denominational heaven, allows you to have all versions of the character of Locke. Like the sad, manipulated man exists. The antagonist, or the antagonist that looks a lot like Locke, exists. And the heroic Locke who basically saves the island until, you know, he has to sacrifice himself, exists. They're all valid readings, which I think is a lot less hairy than, oh yeah, Luke had a Jedi Academy and everyone died because he was a really bad teacher. You know, like that's yada yada yadding over such a complicated part of the entire arc.
That's not how my read on The Last Jedi, but okay. All right.
Well, all right. Yeah. It's not the Luke's like curmudgeon-y stage and then being like letting go at the end of Last Jedi's stuff. That's all fine. I'm talking about the Luke Skywalker arc, where he is a ghost that says a Jedi doesn't throw away like fucking lightsabers after he threw away a lightsaber like 3 weeks before that, like that sort of thing. That I think the Luke arc got poisoned, and maybe because of a reaction to Mark Hamill making a little bit of noise about like how it also wasn't his Luke.
Yeah, I guess that would be the other big difference, would be that Mark Hamill had to do one more movie after The Last Jedi. And then like that whole, everything they did in that movie sort of colors it differently. Whereas with Terry O'Quinn, when you get to the end of Lost, you know, I think it's like Joanna said, there was plenty of room for Terry O'Quinn and any of the cast members to be like, yeah, that didn't go as well as we'd hoped. Because there was so much divisiveness around the finale, but also it was done. Like he didn't have to come back to John Locke later. The Mark Hamill thing is weird because then, you know, the way everybody felt about The Last Jedi sort of influenced what they did in The Rise of Skywalker for better and for significantly worse.
I'm also like really forever mad at lovely Mark Hamill for talking so much shit on Luke and for Vanity Fair for printing it before anyone saw the movie, because the longtime Luke fans, it's like giving them blessing. It's okay if it didn't work for you. It's just sort of like, what if you went in without knowing that thing that Mark Hamill said beforehand? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some people did, but plenty of hardcore fans went in knowing that Mark Hamill didn't like this version of Luke.
Yeah.
And so then they're like sort of prepped. At least Terry O'Quinn in theory waited till the very end.
Yeah. I don't even remember.
That's why they didn't tell him in season 5.
I don't really remember Terry O'Quinn having bad things to say about Lost season 6.
Yeah. I'm going to keep looking for it. I mean, I've been sort of scrolling through while we're talking, and he said some things about the finale, but,
it felt like everybody, any of the sort of negative thoughts didn't happen, at least from like the cast and stuff like that, until after the show was completely done. In fact, the show didn't get super divisive until after the finale, if I remember correctly. But, you know, we'll navigate that as we get through to the likes of Ab Eterno and Across the Sea. And
yeah.
At what point did the fandom really break?
But first, the beginning of season 6.
Yep.
Which brings us to,
Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, next week we're going to see what Kate does. We've seen, you know, what Kate did. What were the other ones? The Kate episodes. What Kate
Born
did.
Born to Run.
There was other ones that were just like what Kate blank. Anyway, Kate.
What Kate married, and the answer was Nathan Fillion.
Nathan Fillion.
So yeah, we're going to see what happens to Kate in The Flash Sideways, and obviously get some Kate on Island stuff. And we're back at the temple, which I'm sure is Very exciting.
Yay, Temple.
I think it's just what Kate did and what Kate does.
Right.
Okay. It's, and maybe you're thinking of whatever the Kate may be.
Right. But it's yeah, whatever the case may be. That was another Kate episode.
So until next week, we'll be back pretending we think there's an alternate timeline. Where can people find your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at the filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects or at one perfect shot. If you're a member of our Patreon Slack, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, you'll know that the Stream Together Watch Alone project is off for the month of May because I am moving and that takes a lot of time. But in June, we are going to be starting a new show that I think kind of goes well with season 6 of Lost, but well, we're going to announce that in a little bit here.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. We are currently wrapping up, well, there's a couple episodes ago of Mayor of Easttown on the Still Watching podcast. That's really fun. We got a great episode this week with lovely Evan Peters on the show. I've got Little Gold Men going, of course, and then I did a couple podcast appearances lately. I'm not sure when those episodes are going to drop, but I did like a 5 to 6 hour recording for Screen Drafts the final Shakespeare draft with Game of Thrones' own Brian Cogman, as well as Graham Skipper and the lovely Maureen Lee Linker. So that was one of the longest experiences of my life. So if you have a whole day to listen to a podcast, you can talk about Never Tightening Up. That's that show. And then I also did an episode of the Marvel Pull List podcast, where they asked me to pick a copy, a comic or comic run to talk about, and I picked Matt Fraction and David Ayala's Hawkeye. So you can check me out on those shows as well.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where this past week we played trivia with the Quiz Quiz Bang Bang podcast. So we get to, you know, listening to lots of fun filler words like ums and ahs and dumb jokes. That's for you. Check out Fighting in the War Room. But otherwise, I'm very happy to be back here on Saturdays at the end of your week to be like, good job. You made it. It worked, but don't fall down next week.